Welcome to this episode of the My Journey as a Physicist podcast. Each episode features an interview with a physicist to learn about their work, their interests outside of physics, and their professional journey of how they ended up where they are today. Season 2 features physicists involved in the particle physics planet community known as Snowmass. Hope you enjoy today's episode.
Well, welcome, Tao. Could you briefly introduce yourself? What is your current job?
Yes. Hello, everybody. My name is Tao Han. I'm a distinguished professor of high energy physics at the University of Pittsburgh. And I joined the faculty at the University of Pittsburgh on the year of 2011. And as a founding director of this, the PITPAC, Pittsburgh Particle Physics, Astrophysics, Cosmology Center. And ever since I have been here, enjoying my teaching and research. I'm also serving as the past chair for APS-DPF. And I was chair last year as APS-DPF. And there's a lot of activities ongoing, in particular, our decadal study for the energy physics in the near future, a lot of the snowmass activities. So I'm very much involved with that. So otherwise, and I usually run annual conference called the Phenomenology Symposium, which attract a large number of junior colleagues, graduate students, postdocs. And, this year, we are very happy to host the in-person meeting after 2 years of pause, and we set a record with 300 people to join about 150 graduate students. I really enjoy the gathering in person and get physics back again. So a lot of activities going on here at Pittsburgh. So I'm happy to discuss any other further things afterwards.
Yeah, that's really cool. Can you describe what your specific research kind of looks at and what questions are you attempting to answer?
That's right. So my research direction is theoretical particle physics, and in particular, it's called phenomenology. I mentioned a meeting called the Phenomenology Symposium. Phenomenology is kind of a branch in theoretical physics that builds a bridge between the theoretical model and the mathematical abstract theory ideas into the observables, such as experiments. So phenomenology is a theoretical branch to work on both theoretical construction and translate that into the experimental observables. In particular, my recent work has been focusing on the Higgs boson properties and the Higgs boson discoveries, and also in connection with the physics beyond standard model possibly, such as a connection with the neutrino models and such as a connection with the possible dark matter and maybe some other early universe consequences. So basically it's a phenomenology in between the collider physics and low energy observations and to go beyond the standard model.
Yeah. Can you kind of describe what the day-to-day of a theoretical physicist sort of looks like? Is it working out math on a chalkboard? Is it a lot of computational simulation type stuff? Like, what does that look like?
Yes, that's very interesting and also exciting too. Seems that day by day and almost like a repetition. In fact, it's not. And in terms of the theoretical work, you want to, fundamentally, we want to understand the nature, how nature works to the smallest, deepest level we can understand. So in order to do that, you typically, from theory viewpoint, you want to have some mathematical, theoretical construction to understand the nature phenomena in the deeper level. So therefore, we usually consider some theoretical models. And once you have some theoretical model, theoretical ideas, you want to translate this theoretical model into experimental observables. And that is the phenomenology. So usually we try to construct the variables, kinematical variables, and interesting physical processes that can be tested, can be observed, can be discovered maybe even by different experiments. So therefore, we are somewhere in between the pure theory and experiment. We could propose experiments. We can propose observable for a given experiment. So that's something we typically do. And once you have this theoretical model, you construct this observable, and you need to do some calculations. You need to do some calculations such as a field theory, quantum field theory calculations, the Feynman diagrams, and that sometimes very involved, very complicated processes. And then you need to define the observables and you need to do some simulations. So therefore, our job actually is very, very broad, not only to understand the theory, but also understand somewhat the experimental implementation. And then you construct the variables and calculate, simulate using Monte Carlo packages, and you develop your own code. So it's very broad and a very intensive research program. And typically I work with my students very closely and with my postdocs very closely as well. And sometimes we have my senior colleagues from other universities as well. Most of the time in terms of my research, I would meet with my students regularly. And so sometimes I mentioned to you that I'm busy with APS-DPF work. and then I close my door. But once I semi open my door, any student can walk in. So it is, I'm very accessible to students, and they walk in to say, "And I have a new idea. What I did here is right or wrong? And my calculation shows me such things." And we will discuss. Sometimes very intense. Sometimes I'm very loud. So then sometimes it's really other next door the neighbors will hear our shouting and discussing and topics. So it's really a dynamic process. And then once we have some final results, we even sometimes consult with our experimental colleagues. PEPAC has a very broad coverage, both in theory and experiments. We may just walk to next door to talk to our experimental colleague to say, "Hey, we have this idea. Is this implementable?" Sometimes they may say, actually, most of the time, they will say, "This is crazy. It's that's not what we do." We said, no, let's try to think this way. Eventually, we try to convince each other. In fact, it's very, very often that theorists, phenomenologists drive some searches. We propose something and we lead these two proposals. Eventually, we come up with a very fruitful results from the experiments. So overall, as you see, that it's very broad coverage, both in terms of topics, but in terms of methods, and in terms of the collaboration with my students and postdocs and colleagues outside the PEPAC University.
Yeah, can you speak to the what collaboration sort of looks like in terms of like how big of a collaborations your research groups are and like who you work with outside of the university and all that?
Right. So this comes to the nature of theoretical collaboration. In fact, this is a point that we cannot do the Zoom type of thing forever, because this is really daily contact that drives the new ideas. I just came back from a conference at Texas A&M. And after 3 years pause, and this is the first meeting after 3 years, and we got together. And we got together just to chat, and just by chatting, you see what you are doing, what you are thinking. And people will come up with their ideas, will say, "Well, that's interesting. Well, that probably has been done. And this hasn't been done." So this is discussion to move our field forward. Okay, so that is the way we start our collaboration. And then, so after this discussion, we come up with certain ideas to say this new idea probably should be implemented. And for example, even during this meeting, I had a discussion with one of my former students to say, "So remember what we did 10 years ago. Now we have some new data. This new data may indicate something different from what we thought. And in fact, it's about the so-called color resonances. And LIC is proton-proton collider. It generates a lot of color interactions, the QCD interactions, lots of new particles. And we come up with new ideas. And we come up with new ideas to say, now we should use our machine learning techniques. Nowadays, we learn so much about machine learning techniques. Let's think about it this way. So having meetings, having in-person interactions, generate new ideas, generate collaborations. Then we go back to see, let me think about this more closely. And then I say, "Oh, I have a student. Actually, he's an expert on this thing. Let's ask this student to look into this." And that's gradually we form the collaboration and we converge on the topics and on the ideas and push forward. Typically, there would be two or three theorists to generate ideas to move on. But sometimes if the students get involved, we don't mind having more students to join. And sometimes we have five people together to have a collaboration. I have a very few paper to my single author. Most of the time, even I come up with ideas, I want to discuss with my colleagues to see whether the ideas make sense and to ask my students check out the literature and to see whether everything should be sensible. The most of the time, I have two, three co-authors to work together. That's how we do. Occasionally, we have a much larger collaboration because of a meeting. Sometimes the meeting has a very intensive discussion. We want to write something out for the outcome of this meeting. And sometimes we call this a white paper, and sometimes we call this conference report. And in that case, we may have 20, 30 people who contributed to the idea, to the discussion during the meeting. And sometimes we do have the report. Those reports are usually very useful, but may not be journal published.
Yeah, and then on the kind of topic of meetings, can you describe what your involvement with the Snowmass kind of collaboration is?
Yes, the Snowmass is a very important practice nowadays in our community, in the particle physics community. The Snowmass name came from this resource village in Colorado near Aspen, 20 miles from Aspen. And that was the small village, very quiet, and resort during the winter time for skiing, but summertime is more quiet, but still very nice for hiking. So in 1982, the American Physical Society Division of Particle Field decided to have a meeting there to be quiet and to stay there for weeks and just exercise the discussions I mentioned. So then a few hundred physicists joined. They start doing this, start talking about this. It turned out that they have a vision to see what we should do for our field in the future. Then by that time, the chair for DPF, Professor Charlie Baltai from Yale University, wrote a report to say, the community feels this is sufficiently important. We should carry out this kind of global discussions in the future. So that's how the SNOMAS started in 1982. Ever since, we started having the discussions, in particular, spearheaded for the SIC, Superconducting Supercollider Program, in the late 80s and early 90s. And we went to SNOMAS more often, more frequently. That my first involvement for SNOMAS was in 1989, and 1990. That was the first two SNOMAS meetings I attended, really at the SNOMAS village, and with 500 physicists to stay there for 3 or 4 weeks. So that was how it started. But later, our field has developed. We continued this tradition. We continue to have this the planning exercise. We want to have a plan for our future in the long-term future, sometimes a decadal, basically 10 years or so. So that's how this current SNOMAS is formatted. So current SNOMAS is formatted at about a 10 years vision for our field, much, much broader than simply particle physics, because it's so much to do with cosmology, and so much to do with other particle physics, so much to do with nuclear physics, and even gravity as well. So now the SNOMAS, the process is a lot broader, but the concept is similar. We want to have a global community planning exercise to have a vision what the most important physical questions should be answered, and what are the possibilities for the experimental projects that would be accessible, available for us to address those fundamental questions. So that is the SNOMAS idea. So my involvement is a little bit accidental. I was elected as chair of American Physical Society Division for Particles and Fields, the DPF chair for the year of 2021, last year. But that election concluded in 2018. So I was on board from the end of 2018. Then the community decided to have this SNOMAS in 2021. It just happened that I would be the chair. So otherwise I would be the chair for this SNOMAS concluding meeting. But unfortunately, as we all know, we experienced such a global pandemic and everything slowed down and we could not carry on in our activity as we wanted. So the SNOMAS concluding meeting was postponed by 1 year. So therefore, the SNOMAS concluding meeting, we call the Community Summer Study, CSS. CSS will take place at the University of Washington, Seattle, June, July 17th through 26th. So that our concluding meeting. However, before the conclusion, we have carried out so much activities for almost 2 years. We have a very broad coverage in the topics. We have 10 frontiers, all the way from theory to frontier, accelerator frontier, energy frontier, neutrino frontier, cosmic, and so on and so forth. And even including early career sector. And the early career colleagues are extremely active, branching out to all the frontiers. They play a significant role, all the frontiers. And then the decision body is called the steering group. So I was a steering group chair last year. Now I'm the pastor chair, but we have 11 people on the steering group, basically the SNOMAS chair line, the four chairs, and plus the other unit representative from nuclear, astro, cosmo, and gravity, and accelerator. So this is the decision-making body at steering group, but then we have the 10 frontiers. Each frontier has roughly about 10 topical groups. Now you see immediately we have 100 small groups to cover the topics. In the last meeting, and of course, unfortunately, was also forced into a virtual meeting. We call this a CPM, a community preparation meeting. We had 3,000 people sign up worldwide. So this is the US exercise. US is such an important partner for the particle physics community worldwide. So we have a direct contact with international communities and also the people from CERN, from Europe, people from Asia, and from Africa, South America, North America. We have an advisory group to cover all these continents and the major research institutions. SNOMAS is a major activity in our field, practically worldwide.
Yeah, and what has your participation and involvement in SNOMAS meant to you?
Yeah, oh, this means a lot to myself and also to the community. So I'm, as I mentioned to you, I'm a member of a student group. So we have almost like weekly meeting. We have weekly meeting to discuss the progress and the reports from the topical groups, what we should plan for this our next meeting. So I have weekly meetings to discuss how to carry on the STROMAT activity. That's on the one hand. On the physical side, I sign up with my personal interest. And my personal interest will be mainly in energy frontier. And of course, energy frontier needs the tools, need a project, need accelerator. So I'm very much involved with the accelerator development for future colliders. And also physics-wise, the energy frontier has a lot to do with the neutrino physics with dark matter, and also sign up with the neutrino frontier, and also sign up with the cosmic frontier. So in terms of physics involvement, I'm overly subscribed. And I have written something like 8 or 9 white papers. And we send our white paper to propose your own personal ideas about the physics and about the future opportunity. So in collaboration with my students and postdocs and colleagues, I think I submit 9 or 8 white papers, individual papers. The topics including the Higgs precision measurement and neutrino mass model test and the dark matter coverage at the future muon colliders and so on and so forth. So physics-wise, I'm very much into that. I learned a lot. One thing that for sure for the STROMAT outcome, our community has learned a lot more because of this exercise, and our junior colleagues have been trained a lot better and a lot better equipped during this STROMAT process.
That's really interesting. That's really impressive, like the scope and size of everything.
Yeah, thank you. I hope you join too.
And so kind of like going back and earlier into your career, what got you interested in physics to begin with?
Ah, that's a very interesting question. My career path in particular in the beginning is not but unusual, because my high school time was at the time during the Chinese Cultural Revolution when I was in China. I did my high school in China. That was the last few years of this so-called Cultural Revolution. It was a total chaotic for the whole country. I did not get a proper education for my high school at all. But after high school, and the Cultural Revolution was still ongoing, and I was sent to the countryside. I did not go to college. I was sent to the countryside to be re-educated. So any intellectuals, including high school kids, you are intellectuals. You have to be re-educated in farms or maybe in the factories. You will be re-educated by workers and peasants. And I was sent to the countryside for 3 years. But of course, that was towards the end of the Cultural Revolution. We all knew it is going to end. It's not going to be like this forever. It's going to finish. So I brought I bought some books, the old books, no new book, no new science books. That science was basically stopped. Okay, no science. I bought some very old textbooks, math, and I like math, and some physics books, and an English book. I taught myself English from that time. I did not have an English course even during the high school. So that was the time I prepared my math and I learned, I taught myself college math calculus by myself there. And I taught English by myself. And so I read some general physics. And then fortunately, 3 years, roughly about 2 years later, the Cultural Revolution ended because Chairman Mao died and the Premier Zhou died in the same year, 1976. So I was lucky. So I was lucky in the right time in 1977, I went back to college. So that was a time randomly I got into physics. I did like math, but I did not have very clear about physics and chemistry, other things. But nevertheless, I got into physics department in Nankai University, one of the very prominent universities in China, and essentially Beijing suburb. And we went and discussed things and went to Beijing all the time. It's a really suburb, it's a really Beijing area. So that's where I basically grew up with my science. And I was in the major, something like electronics. It was a very weird major. It's called a radio major. But okay, radio. So it's basically electronics. But I did not like it. And I was really bad with my lab. I'm really bad using my hand. So I did not like it. But it was a chaotic time. And then there were three groups of people in the same time with our same class, two classes actually. Some people, high school, just graduated, a couple of years younger than me. Something like 3 years or 4 or 5 years younger than me. And I was in group in the intermediate, the more normal, because it experienced the Cultural Revolution 10 years older than me in the same class. Because these people came to college 10 years ago in the beginning of Cultural Revolution, but they did not get any college education. They came back again. So our classes is really, in terms of age distribution, it's a huge difference. That university could not handle. So was in really beginning of the end of Cultural Revolution, university said, okay, let's have a replacement test. The university held a placement test. So I was lucky to pass a placement test, and they had 20 people out of 300 better prepared. They said it's 20 people better prepared. We started learning theoretical physics, classical mechanics, classical E&M, and thermodynamics and quantum mechanics. That got my real interest. And then pretty much from then, I got into that. And I got into the master program, a graduate program. That was the beginning. That was no master program in China. So no PhD. So only after that, the master program restarted and the PhD program resumed. So I got into the master program. I finished my master program in particle physics and there, and I applied. I was once again lucky. So unluckiness, you saw this already, but I was lucky. Then I got into University of Wisconsin for my PhD program. And ever since then, my career basically fly.
And if you don't mind sharing, like, how was that transition from living in China into transitioning now you're in the US?
That was very hard. That was pretty hard, not like nowadays. Nowadays, the two countries have been open to each other for more than 20 years, so something like 30 years. So the younger generation in China, they know the US very well. They know the language. They know the culture very, very well. They have been exposed sufficient to the Western style and also the education system. They are very well prepared. My new students come here. I think they are very, very well prepared. You don't need to tell them to teach them too much. My time was different. My time, when I came here, there was not many students. I arrived here in 1985 to Wisconsin, but that was not the worst time. In the beginning, in the 1979, 1981, that was early time, even earlier, so even harder. But I arrived there rather early time. So I told you, I learned English rather late. I came to the US to study my PhD program. It's also very late. I was put off by the Cultural Revolution and also being assigned as lecturer. And in fact, it's called teaching assistant in the university. And so I was 5 to 7 years later than most of my peers. So therefore, actually, in essence, I'm seven years older than all my peers because of that delay. I was very late. It was such a difficult adjustment for me to adjust myself into the new environment, which I actually did not have a very clear idea before, and culturally, and also language barrier. It took me quite some time to really make friends with I was a TA in the physics department, and try to make friends with them, to play with them, and to learn American football. And I only like soccer and ping pong, but now I learned American football. All these things, you need to adjust yourself to change. I think I adapted myself well, but it was really deep curve to make the adjustment. Physics-wise, I was really well prepared. I got my master's degree before I came here. In fact, I even have one publication before I came here already. So I was really well prepared. And culturally, all the other community and society, it took a long time for us to adjust to learn.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that. Outside of physics, like, do you have any interests or hobbies, or like, are you just doing physics all the time?
No, I have a lot of hobbies, actually. I do physics day and night, as you know. So even at midnight, I can easily receive email and reply the email, maybe from my colleagues in Asia, in Europe. I do it day and night. However, I do manage to find some time to do something else. Nowadays I do walking and jogging basically every day and trying to keep myself in shape. But also in the meantime, when I walk, when I jog, I think I organize myself for my work. So I usually take about 30 minutes to 1 hour to walk about 10,000 steps. And so that's my kind of a daily goal. That's my basically the major hobby that I'm doing. But of course, during weekends, I try to watch movies. I like watching movies. And sometimes I go to concerts with my family, with a family member. And so here at Pittsburgh, we have a very convenient, very world-class symphony orchestra. And during weekend, I do that. So that's pretty much the major thing. But I do watch sports. And now I watch NBA finals. And I have to be a Steelers fan, being in Pittsburgh for 10 years. Mm-hmm. So I follow this very closely. I do watch the games too. So that's basically it. However, beyond that, I have other hobbies which are rather irregular. I play instrument. I play the flute. I play the Chinese flute. It's a very small bamboo. and pretty well. So, but that's very irregular, maybe only a few times for occasion for a year. I play ping pong. I used to play ping pong for long hours when I was a kid back in China. Now I try to play ping pong with my daughters and to train them. But those things are my hobbies, but they're rather irregular.
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear about your diverse set of interests.
Yeah, thank you. It was so some other hobbies take you off your mind from your focus, but that actually sharpens your thinking when you come back.
Yeah, for sure. So sort of wrapping things up, one final question I'd like to ask is, like, do you have any advice for students or young researchers kind of starting their physics career?
Yes, I do. I have had a lot of students, a lot of good students. And I actually now, I think this year I finished two more PhD students. I think I probably have more than 20 PhD students graduated. So I really enjoy working with my students and at different levels. All the students have a different talents. Some students are a little bit quicker, some students are slower but deeper, but some students are more skillful in computation. Some students are more skillful in thinking. Some students are better than me in certain aspects. I really enjoy working with students. In terms of the advice, I want to tell the students, you must develop your passion. You must like it. You want to work with me. Look, I'm always pretty loud. We always start almost like shouting, but we are just debating physics. We're debating science. You must have your passion. You need your passion first. Once you have a passion, then you want to be persistent. You want to be persistent, hardworking. You want to figure out what is going on until you figure that out. You want to be very persistent, never give up. So passion, persistence, that's the key for my advice to students and to the success. Okay. And the side remark, some luck is needed. Luckiness is necessary. However, I told my student, luck is there waiting for you, waiting for the best prepared. If you are not prepared, you miss it. Don't blame on other people. People miss the chances over again, not learning them. You must have your passion, give out your passion, and prepare yourself to the best level you can. Whenever there's an opportunity, whenever the luck comes, you seize it. And then you continue, you develop, and you go on from there. So that's basically my frequent discussions with my junior colleagues and my students.
I really like that advice. Thank you for sharing. And thank you for coming on and doing this. I had a great time talking with you and learning about your experiences.
You're welcome, Brian. Thank you very much for doing this.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. This podcast was created by Brian Stanley and Professor Wei-Win Lin. Season 2 was edited by Varley Sakorikar. Thank you for listening.